You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. The often trotted out cliché about people seeing strange things in the skies often refers to them as being flying saucers. Yet, when you examine any large number of the sightings, it quickly becomes evident that people see all kinds of shaped objects in the skies. As a researcher, investigator, publisher, and conference organiser, Chris Evers has 50 years of experience in the field of ufology. In his new book, The Shape of Things to Come from Elsewhere, Chris shows us that witnesses often report numerous shaped objects. It seems that there are far more things in the skies than simply flying saucers. But before that, as always, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. You can also click the link in the show notes as usual. And thank you to each and every one of you that continue to support me and the show through your Patreon contributions. Thank you. Mysteries and Monsters are across all social media platforms. Please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. And don't forget, you can visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for episodes and merchandise. Our intro and outro music is performed by the marvellous Weary Pines. Thank you to Dean Bestel, as always, for his wonderful artwork. The show is produced by Brendan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys. And Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. Now, Chris Evers joins us to talk about the shape of things to come from elsewhere. The often rolled out cliche about UFOs or UAPs that refers to flying saucers, but yet this doesn't take long to see this just isn't correct. Since a sighting almost 50 years ago, Chris Evers has built a reputation of one of the UK's most knowledgeable ufologists. From publishing his own magazine to hosting regular conferences, Chris has now released his debut book, The Shape of Things to Come from Elsewhere. Chris, I'm delighted to welcome you to the show for your very first time.
Hello there, Paul. Thank you. Yes, it's the first time that we've met like this. Don't tell the wife.
Well, it's quite rare. Usually I meet people after they've been on the show, but I met you at my first ever sort of paranormal UFO conference back in 2019 in the wild worlds of Pontefract back then, Chris.
And yeah,
so
that's correct.
It's usually the other way around, so I'm delighted to finally get a chance to have you on the show and obviously tied in with your brilliant new book that's just come out. So welcome and thanks for making time to join me.
Can I just correct you? I'm not knowledgeable. I actually make it up as I go along. It's that's quite a big praise to say to somebody. So thank you for that, Paul. Very, very much appreciated. Thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome. I consider you one of those people, Chris, in this field as a knowledge secret, because I think anybody that's into this subject, especially in the UK, knows you very well. Mm. And I think you're as you've just shown there, you're quite a humble man who has been and gone from ufology a few times over the years for a variety of reasons, which is entirely understandable. Many of us get fed up with our favorite subjects, and this is this is certainly one that drives most of us mad at the best of times. So I've always been aware of you for probably, I don't know, 10 or 15 years, Chris, in the field of ufology, and obviously as a fellow Yorkshireman over there on the East
Coast. That's the important bit. Forget the ufology.
Well, we're building up a Yorkshire mafia in regards to strange phenomena, I think, Chris, with us two and Paul Sinclair.
Philip Mantle.
Yes, yes.
He's a proper Yorkshireman, though, isn't he? I call him his Royal Highness, the Prince Philip, you know. That comes back from the days when we used to do a podcast together. So he takes it as a joke, which is very, very good of him, I must admit.
Yeah, Sir Philip of Pontefract. Absolutely. And then obviously we've got David Clark as well, haven't we?
So yeah, it's true, yeah.
And I'm sure we'll touch on that later on when we're talking about strange shaped objects, especially after everything that's happened over the last sort of 18 months in regards to Calvin. Mm. So, as I mentioned in the introduction, Chris, you, as a young chap, immersed in the entertainment at the time, late 60s, early 70s, you've got Doctor Who, Thunderbirds, UFOs and things like that. Was it just something until you had your sighting as a young teenager that you were just imagined as a form of entertainment rather than a reality until you saw your first light in the sky, as it was?
Yeah, it was really, really a very passing interest that I had in the subject. I'll tell you how I got interested in it. I used to go every now and again and stay at my uncle's home. My uncle Jeff, who's no longer with us, unfortunately. Mm. But I used to go and stay at his home. And of course, being a young lad, 13, 14, you know, I don't want to go to bed at 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, you know. I want to stay up a bit longer. So anyway, I'd go up into the bedroom where I was sleeping, mm. and there was a pile of books in the corner, mostly about ghost stories, mm. more than anything else, but with the occasional UFO mentioned here and there and the occasional UFO book. Anyway, I would read these books, you know, stay up half past 9, 10 o'clock, half 10, you know, and end up scaring myself to death reading ghost stories and, you know, things about Bally Rectory and all this kind of stuff. And anyway, I'd fall to sleep with a light on, you know, because I was that scared. But so I knew a very, very small amount of information about, you know, UFOs, basically what they were supposed to be back in those days, you know, flying saucers. And that was basically how it was. I had no real interest in the subject whatsoever until, of course, my February 1974, 50 years ago, in just a couple of weeks' time.
Yeah.
Since I had my first UFO sighting. Well, I call it a UFO sighting. It was an unexplained sighting in reality, but I said UFO because, as you mentioned in the intro there, I was into things like Doctor Who, Star Trek, which was new at the time, you know, the original series in the UK, and you know things like Gerry Anderson's Thunderbirds, which led on to like Joe Nanti and the UFO TV series, and Commander Ed Straker and all that, like, you know, trying to save the Earth from the aliens. So it comes out in the series that the aliens are coming to Earth in UFO, the TV series, to get organs to transplant to their people on their planet. So I wonder where that idea came from.
Yeah.
Anyway, it was just a really, really passing interest, Paul.
I think it's quite interesting as well because we're quite spoilt these days. And I think especially from sort of the 90s onwards, Chris, when ufology really exploded across the world and numerous cases came to the forefront and are still with us today. Rendlesham and Roswell are the two usual suspects. But I know back in that period, it seemed, as you refer to there, and I've heard it from other people, trying to track down books about UFOs as a young lad in the 70s seemed to be searching for the Holy Grail, because you might stumble across the odd one or two here or there, but not much was really covered about them. And I know when I've heard you speak before and others of our vintage, Chris, the Warminster thing keeps getting mentioned, which is probably one of those cases where people go, oh, well, it's all been solved now. These two guys said they made their sightings up and therefore everything, that explains everything else away. Mm. Was that something that you became aware of when you discovered your terrifying sort of love-hate relationship with the paranormal at that age, Chris? Or was that something you kind of discovered as you developed a more pertinent interest in the subject as you grew up?
Well, the subject, really, well, I mean, looking for books, as you pointed out, it was like looking for the Holy Grail. Mm. You know, it was like looking for the gold at the end of the rainbow, to put it politely. You know, everything seemed to come from America, you know, back in the 50s and 60s. I suppose, really, because that's where what we now know as the modern UFO era began.
Yeah.
In 1947, Kenneth Arnold's sighting. Mm. A week later or so, you know, we had the Roswell incident.
Yeah.
But anyway, it was like looking for the Holy Grail. So looking for books, I was brought up, as I point out in my own book, you know, my new book, I was brought up in a one-parent family. We couldn't afford to go out and buy brand new books. So thank God for the local lending library, you know, where I'd go get a book on the Monday and take it back on the Friday because I'd read it, you know. And it was all that. And books by, as you mentioned, the Warminster thing, Major Donald Kehoe.
Yeah.
Books that he'd written. So yes, some of them were written in the 50s, you know. So to some extent, I suppose that's why I'm a little bit more nuts and bolts kind of individual, you know, than I am something that's coming through some, I don't know, out of this world kind of a transportation system, you know. Granted, though, if they are using a nuts and bolts craft, you know, they're going to need some kind of warp engine type device to get to the Earth, because we know really of the nearest star system, nearest star to us is it Sirius, 4.3 light years, I think it is, from the Earth. So that's a hell of a distance. So, you know, if they're going to travel to us, they need some kind of fantastic engine, some kind of fantastic device where they can warp time and space around them. Perhaps they've even got a TARDIS, who knows?
Well, I think often as well, as with any kind of 14 subject, Chris, sometimes people are so entrenched in their belief about what something can be, what the explanation is, as you refer to there about UFOs. Some people, to them, it's all or nothing. They are nuts and bolts, physical craft that are traveling across the universe from parts unknown to come here for reasons unknown in many cases. But I think sometimes, because, you can apply this to the paranormal, to cryptozoology or everything, sometimes you can have more than one solution to a problem, because if we're to believe that intelligent life is traveling here, who's to say that they're not using different methods to get here? Are they punching through a wormhole? Are they using a warp drive to get here? Are they, as other people have postulated, are they time travelers coming backwards for a school trip or whatever? Where do you kind of sit on that as you've developed throughout your career, Chris? Have you kind of, because I think one of the things I've said a few times doing this is, when I started doing the show 5 years ago, I thought I was quite well-versed in a lot of things. Now, 5 years on, I realise I knew very little, and I was nowhere near as open-minded as I used to think I was. I think I've, speaking to people such as yourself over the years and other researchers and investigators on a variety of topics, I've realised that not everything has one answer. And that doesn't necessarily mean that it's wrong or it's a figment of people's imagination. There can be different solutions to the same question.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I'm not set in stone in, you know, because I'm saying I'm a little bit, you know, Paul Sinclair called me an old school ufologist, so I suppose I am in some respect. But, you know, I'm happy to change my opinion, to change my mind. You know, if people can show me some kind of intelligent or scientific ideas to suggest that, for example, they're using a different type of propulsion to get here, then I'm more than happy to change my opinion. I'm not set in stone, because rightly, as you say, Paul, quite often, even in life, you know, we get problems every day in life, which sometimes is more than one solution to. So, yeah, I completely agree. But just give me some grounded, you know, responsible answers to the questions. Because there's a lot of, in my opinion, there's a lot of, I'm not going to mention anything, but there's a lot of airy-fairy beliefs in the ufology subjects itself. But I'm not going to go into them. I'm just going to leave that. And, you know, I'm just going to carry on doing what I'm doing and looking for, well, I'm not really looking for answers anymore. I'm more of, in fact, I'm more of a reporter than an investigator stroke researcher. So, you know, I'm kind of like, my focus has just slightly changed.
Well, I think with anything, you mature as a person in regards to a lot of things that we do and enjoy in life, Chris. And I think sometimes people kind of think that these things aren't as time consuming or as or can drive you crazy as I was referring to earlier. And I think sometimes as we mature and we develop as people, we can sometimes shift our focus to things that probably feel more beneficial. And I think obviously with yourself publishing the magazine and other things that you've done over the years, Chris, because obviously you've been a field researcher, you've been involved in with other luminaries of the field in the UK over the years.
Mm-hmm.
I think there comes a point where you think, well, it's not that you're giving up. Sometimes you just kind of pass the baton on to other people and say, right, you can go wandering around muddy fields for
10 hours on a cold February night, and I'll stay at home and write up about it.
Yeah.
And I think when we get to a, you get to a certain point where that's a far more beneficial thing for everybody. But I think it's very similar to the kind of work that Peter Davenport did with the in the US, that his database was more about him collecting the reports. And if he had a major incident that he felt had real value, he would then go out for it.
Mm-hmm.
He wouldn't seem to chase the phenomenon. Whereas I think sometimes you can get so lost in this subject and other parts of Fortiana as well. I think this applies to as well, Chris, that it takes over for some people.
Yeah.
and it becomes everything and everything else falls apart. And I think you develop a knack or a technique of knowing when to exert that amount of energy onto a particular case or a particular witness or something, and sometimes just sit back and let it come to you.
Absolutely, yeah. I am happy if an enthralling, thrilling case comes my way, you know, and it hasn't been investigated by others, and I will go out and I will investigate it. But as you rightly point out, Paul, I'm happy to sit back at the age of 64 in April, you know, and basically stay warm, you know, in the middle of winter anyway,
yeah.
You know, and I do go out on the occasional sky watch. In fact, myself and my son, Kevin, we went out on a sky watch to Bempton,
yep.
The haunt of Paul Sinclair. And we actually saw something which was very, very unusual, close down. I can't remember the name now. The platform. And Paul has told me, I think, forgive me if I'm wrong, Paul, but I think it was called Ghost Rocks, I think, if I remember correctly. I'm not 100% certain of that. Where we saw a single ball of light floating around very close to the cliff edge at the Bempton Cliffs. It was floating around very close to the water. Now, at first, my son and I, we thought, oh, perhaps somebody's lobster potting or crab potting, whatever, at this time of night.
Yeah.
But then we realised, and it was round about midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning, and it was middle of summer. So we realised that nobody would be out at that time of night with one single light on a boat, on a ship, bringing in pots at that time of night. The whole deck would have been lit up, but it was one single light moving around very close, you know, to the cliffs there at Bempton. So that, I suppose I could say, that's like my third sighting that I've seen.
Mm.
And it's a subject which, yeah, you can walk away from, but there is something that niggles at the back of your head. I had my sighting, as I said, 50 years ago nearly, and I'm still looking for an answer to that sighting. I don't think now I'm going to get one, but I'll still keep looking, keep reading, and sharing of information, which is my main task now, to get information out. You know, so I'm always on the lookout for good articles to go in the mag, or, you know, bits of information that I can share with all the subscribers.
Mm. I think as well, Chris, for yourself, I'm always intrigued by people that have an interest in this particular subject, who then sort of take that next step to become an investigator, as you did as a man in your mid-20s when you were working alongside Tony Dodd and obviously got to know Birdsalls and things like that.
Yeah.
Was that what you feel, because of your personal sighting and your interest combined, that it just continued to develop, that you thought, I really want to get out there and get to know these people?
What I did, Paul, originally, is when my sighting occurred, as I said, I kind of started investigating it in 1974 by reading up material. I was looking for an answer to what I'd seen in those books, but none of those people had put anything in the books that would answer my question.
Mm.
So I carried on digging for that answer to my question, and it was that eventually led me to start investigating other sighting reports. You know, we've had a case from Sprawley where we had an alien face at the window.
Yes.
No, I actually caught that in December 1994, and I went along and interviewed the two ladies involved in January 1995, and we put that in, I think it was one of the first magazines I'd put together for the then Hull UFO Society, which I founded in the mid-90s.
Mm.
And we put all that out. And so, but it was all this head knowledge that I had, which led to me, obviously, when I saw UFO magazine on the counter there, it was actually that I had to buy it, and it, obviously I wanted to meet the people behind it and get to know them, and I got to know them over a few years. You know, we had Graham Birdsall and Russ Callaghan come up to Hull.
Yeah.
I think it was in 97 where they came along and they did a Monday night conference for us in the old Middleton Hall before, you know, it seated round about 310 people, and we filled it in the, you know, at February time, 1997, at the height of the craze for the X-Files. So yeah, the X-Files did bring a lot of people into it, as you kind of mentioned earlier on. And as I got to know these people, you know, Graham Birdsall, Russ Callaghan, Mark Birdsall, Tony Dodd, I met Gary Ezeltan, you know, I met another guy whose name I've completely forgotten now, so forgive me. But we actually set up another magazine, a paper-based magazine called East Yorkshire Encounters. Gary Anthony, sorry, that's who I'm talking about. He was a member of Euphora.
Yeah.
He led me on to people like Jenny Randalls, who she kindly sent us an article. You know, I knew of Dave Clark and people like that. So I've known a lot of people over the years, and I've gradually, you know, just read more and more and more. And I wanted to use that information and think logically, or try to think logically, because I'm not from Vulcan or anything like that. But, you know, try to think logically about answering questions as to what people were seeing and reporting, and trying to find them an answer as well as myself. And so obviously it led on to me getting more involved with Quest International and Tony Dodd's investigation organisation.
Yeah. Do you think, I know up until about 10 years ago, I know some people sort of looked at that early 90s, mid-90s period in a kind of warm, reminiscing glow, as though those were the glory days, Chris, and we would never see the likes of it again. And yet, it seems everything that's gone on over the last 6 years, we seem to be closer to that particular period, probably without as much baggage or fake corpses being shown as real things around the world, famously, than we've ever had previously. And I think sometimes what I've often seen, because I keep a foot in several camps, is a lot of people would say, oh, well, we don't have any big cases anymore. And I'm just thinking, well, you only would presume that if you don't really take an interest in it, because there's been some major cases over the last 20 years, both here and abroad.
Yeah.
And I just think that sometimes that you've got the, like the rock stars, as I mentioned earlier on, of certain cases that mainstream media will always go back to in a sort of never-ending loop.
Mm-hmm.
But as we've touched on earlier, we've had the O'Hare incident in Chicago in the last 20 years.
Yeah, the airport, yeah.
You've got all the great work that Paul's been doing over at Bempton and some of the things going on over there. We've got strange sightings. Obviously, we're doing this interview 3 days after this whole aliens running amok in Miami stories hit the headlines, which I've seen some dodgy things with a red ring around them over the years, Chris. I've no idea what they're looking at there.
What you've got to remember, Paul, is what we're calling, i.e. the 1990s and earlier, the golden years, didn't seem like golden years to us. Like today doesn't seem like golden days, shall we say?
Yeah.
But, you know, in another 5-10 years, we may look back and think, oh, hang on a minute, that case is similar to this case back in XYZ year. So, you know, we can look at things differently, and time and distance does give you a different perspective.
Mm. Yeah. I think it's one of those things that I've always, over the last sort of 5 or 6 years, Chris, tried not to look backwards and always look forwards. And I found it to be a far more beneficial thing. And one of the biggest regrets I'll ever have in my life is the fact that I was never aware that John Keel did a talk in Sheffield in 1996.
No, I missed that.
Which, you know, me, when I found that out, went bananas with myself, thinking, well, you love the X-Files. You were a subscriber to the 14 Times at that period. Why didn't I go? And I, to this day, cannot tell you how I didn't go or why it didn't appear on my radar or anything, Chris. And I think sometimes we can worry too much about what's happened rather than what we can achieve, as I said to you earlier about moving from being an investigator to sort of a researcher and a cataloguer rather and a correspondent in regards to this phenomena these days. And I think, for me anyway, I think we've got away from that kind of, oh, well, it's never going to be that good again anymore. Primarily, I think, as well, because we've had such great work done by David Clark and colleagues in regards to the infamous Calvin photo, which people have dismissed for years.
Yeah.
And that, it's one of those things, especially with the report that appeared back in the New York Times in 6 years ago now, there seems to have been a real line drawn in the sand. And I can't remember over the last 30 years where this subject seems to be spoken about in a far more nuanced and balanced manner without the usual cliches of people playing the X-Files music whenever they talk about it or accusing us all of wearing tinfoil hats, which with my hairline, Chris, would just cause an unusual amount of sweating.
I'll keep some of mine, Paul.
I'm always on the lookout.
No, things have changed. On that date, 17th of December 2017, when the New York Times, as we all know, if we follow the subjects, we all know that things changed in that they published a front page article admitting that the Pentagon had admitted they'd lied to us. Even though some now are trying to claw back this, the information from the public domain, I think the cat's out of the bag. Mm. To me, we've had disclosure, and it was on that day in 2017. You know, they've admitted there is something behind UFOs. They do not know what it is, so they say.
Mm.
But, you know, I think we've had that disclosure. We're not going to get a president or a vice president or, you know, the leader of the United Nations sitting down in front of a TV camera and going, yeah, okay, guys, we've lied. There is UFOs are real. We are being visited. They've still got to control the narrative because they feel they have to.
Hmm.
They don't want to admit everything to us. But hang on a minute. NASA was supposed to be setting up a panel to investigate UFO sightings, which they said they couldn't do. As you, if you saw the announcement when it went on the internet last year, 2023, if you saw that announcement, they said, we don't have the information.
Mm.
Well, what a load of rubbish.
Yeah.
They could go back at least 70 years to at least 1947, you know, and the famous Roswell Kenneth Arnold sightings of that time period.
Mm.
They could investigate those. They've got the information.
Hmm.
But they don't want to have to bring it out yet. And I think that is because they want to control the narrative. And the reason America wants to do that is because they don't want to give any advantages to potential adversaries.
Hmm.
And it's as simple as that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's peculiar on a number of levels, really, Chris, because there is this kind of aspect to that you say there, what NASA have said. And even if you just sit back and think about it, you just think, well, why don't they just look at Project Blue Book then? You've got ready-made historical document there that covers thousands of cases from all parts of North America with investigations, keynotes, witness statements, whatever. And to sit there in 2023 and say, well, we've not got enough information is ludicrous at best.
Yeah, I agree.
We're not asking them to start interviewing specific investigators or take first-hand accounts from some dubious characters that still inhabit this particular subject from all across the world.
Mm-hmm.
There is physical evidence, and from trained observers, you know, military personnel, police officers, healthcare officials, ship
pilots.
Captains, pilots. There are numerous
spacemen.
People.
Yeah.
Astronauts. Yeah. Yeah. Cosmonauts.
When I say spacemen, of course, yeah. I mean, astronauts,
yeah. The ones we've sent up there.
Cousin Zog from Zeta Reticuli, you know.
Well, the Mantis people aren't very talkative to NASA. They've still got a big fallout with them. But it's frustrating, like you say, that it's almost like they've still got their heads in the sand.
Yeah.
When everything around them, everybody's shouting, but what about this? What about that? And they're just going, no, 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 I can't hear you.
Well, don't forget, though, Paul, there's not just the official documentation. What about MUFON?
Hmm?
What about British UFO Research Association?
Yeah.
What about the National UFO Reporting Centre? And MUFON and NUFORC, I mean, well, let's take NUFORC, for example. In their 47 years of existence up till November 2022, they actually had, they have 147 plus thousand cases in their documentation that they've acquired over the years. You know, they could take the government could go to one of those kind of organizations and say, look, we're not here to admit anything. We're not going to say anything, but we'd like to look at your documentation, please, just to see what you've got.
Yeah.
You know, Yeah. Why can't they just do that? Get off their high horses and actually ask for help.
Yeah, yeah. I think the other aspect of this is that the narrative still seems to be focused purely on craft, Chris. Mm. There is no mention of any sort of abduction experiencer investigation here, which I find a little odd.
If they do that, Paul, they're opening up a whole different... Well, it's a completely different ball game than they are admitting. We're looking into abductions. That is like saying, yes, we are being visited. And they won't come to that yet until they say, yes, UFOs are real. And we think, because don't forget, every time that they announce, oh, we've looked at this report, we've released that report, they always say there's no proof of extraterrestrial visitation. They have to admit that first before they go to abductions.
Mm. Yeah. But, yeah, I get the official... standpoint on it, but I just find it a bit odd because it's almost as if they're trying to compartmentalize it, Chris. And yeah, as we both know, there are numerous cases where that is impossible to do so, because you'll have people who have a lifetime of experiences, you'll have people with no interest in the subject who find themselves caught in the middle of some kind of maelstrom that they can't comprehend. You have some people that don't see craft, they just see beings. You have people that see craft and no beings. You see people that see craft that feel as though they're having some kind of conversation without seeing anybody.
Mm-hmm.
It's weird. Are they going to be in a situation where if they do come across a case that overlaps these parameters that they've decided upon, are they just going to disregard it? Are they going to preach, even if it's the best case, are they just going to go, oh, well...
They'll probably look into it, but they won't admit to looking into it. Mm. And what they'll do is they'll put it in its whole little cubbyhole out of the way, and they'll keep it from... prying eyes. Well, we know they hide things because in 1947 they were called flying discs.
Mm.
You know, that changed in the 50s to UFOs.
Mm.
Then that has changed now to UAPs, and they keep shifting the goalposts by doing that. So if you send in a Freedom of Information request and you're asking for all the information on UFOs, yeah, they'll gear that, but you'll miss out on the more modern cases because now they call them UAPs. So they keep shifting the goalposts because people like me, people like you, and other researchers and investigators, and in my case, reporters, are looking for information to put out there. So they'll try to add it and again control the release of documentation and information.
I mean, when it comes to your book, Chris, it's one of those subjects that, as I said to you before we started the interview, I get a book sometimes that I read or I stumble across somehow, and I'll just think, why has nobody ever written a book like this? Because for me, I think for somebody to sit down and take the time and say, right, because as we were saying there about what you've got to ask for to get the information... It amazes me that people still consider flying saucers as the only thing people see. Mm. And they still do it.
But that was a wrong description, wasn't it, Paul?
Yes, yeah. Well, he never said
Kenneth
that.
Kenneth Arnold saw. Kenneth Arnold, he called them like pie dishes.
Yep.
He said one of them, in fact, he described two different shapes, one of which was crescent-shaped.
Yeah.
And it had, but if you can imagine the crescent shape, it had like a bat wing.
Yes.
At the back, kind of a feature.
Yeah.
Which some people say was, you know, the Horton HO, was it 29 or 209 or 9 or something?
Yeah.
Which was developed by the Germans in the Second World War.
Mm.
But that isn't correct because the Horton, the surviving example that was shipped to America was actually about 18 months before the Kenneth Arnold sighting. I've got a document from 18 months before then where they said they would not make the Horton suitable for flying again.
Mm-hmm.
It was just an experimental thing. Now, don't tell me they can design and make an aircraft in 18 months that can do what Kenneth Arnold's aircraft did in 1940. Sorry, flying saucer did in 1947, because they couldn't do that and get it airworthy.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, and let's not forget, Arnold wasn't just your average Joe. He was an experienced pilot.
Yeah. He was indeed. And don't forget, he was out there while he saw the two different shapes. He was looking for a crashed aircraft, which he was after getting, I think it was something like a $5,000 reward.
Yeah, it was a rescue mission, wasn't it?
Which was a hell of a lot of money back in 1947.
Yeah, absolutely. So sometimes when, as we've touched on earlier, sometimes they'll dismiss witnesses as saying, oh, well, they don't know what they're looking at. And when Arnold's one of those people that go, oh, you know, I've heard all kinds of explanations as to what it was, Chris. The reflective properties of geese, I think, is one of the ones that he just saw.
There must have been bloody big geese, that's all I can say, Paul.
Yeah, big and fast, because obviously a lot of people ignore his entire... They just focus on what he saw. They don't seem to look into everything else, you know, his description about the distance he saw them from, how long he saw them for, how he worked out the speed.
Look into the report, you know, we worked at the flight out is by the engine fastener on the front of his aircraft, I remember if it was on the wing of his aircraft or the front of the nose of his aircraft, but he worked out the distance it would be for these crescent-shaped devices, whatever, flying in the distance, how long it would take them to fly from a point on his aircraft to another point on his aircraft. So clearly he was an experienced pilot who knew exactly what he was looking at, and he worked out something like, was it 1,200 mile an hour?
Yeah.
Which was at least twice as fast as any commercial aircraft or aircraft at the time.
Yeah, yeah. When you sit down and look at that, and we go on this sort of cliche, as I say, about flying saucers, regardless of the media deciding that's what it was. It's like the Hopkinsville incident, Chris. None of the witnesses describe little green men at all. All the media reports say residents see little green men. Well, they never said that in any statement at all.
What you've got to remember is, though, that these newspapers and other, even modern day media outlets, all they're interested in is, i.e. newspapers selling papers. It's all about money. And when you get down to radio broadcasts, it's all about getting the listeners in, especially for the commercial stations. So they will put their own slant on what is seen to make it sound just maybe a little bit better than it actually was. Because they know if they say, again, let's bring up Cousin Zog from Zeta Reticuli. If they say Cousin Zog's been seen walking around, Kingston upon Hull in East Yorkshire at last night at 6 p.m., they know people in Kingston upon Hull in East Yorkshire are going to buy the newspaper where all that is, you know, or they're going to listen to radio stations where all that is mentioned.
Yeah.
It's all about figures and numbers at the end of the day, that is.
Of course it is. It clickbait in a variety of forms.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's not just an internet web page that tries to entice you in. And so when you sit down to look at it, building this catalogue of the variety of things that people have seen, even I think anybody who's got a bit of interest in this particular subject will know straight away that flying saucer is one particular shape of craft.
Yeah.
Were you, even with your experience, Chris, surprised at the variety that people report? Because this is often the thing that people go, oh, well, nobody sees triangles anymore. Nobody sees balls anymore. Exactly.
But they do. That's just the thing. Things seem to come in waves. You know, we had the triangles in Belgium in the late, was it 80s, early 90s?
Yeah.
You know, in our days, we seem to get orbs.
Yeah.
But, you know, I can tell you, which actually I mention it in the book, there's a story of, I think it was a priest in Japan who was going to be executed. You know, I'm pretty sure it was a daylight execution. I don't know what he'd done. I don't know what he'd said or anything, but he was going to be executed. And he was well known and well loved. And of course, they got a big audience to actually seeing this. And they witnessed something come down from the sky, which was large, round, and silver, and they said it was moon-shaped. So that is a round object which was seen then. You know, we can go back to Roman times, which I mentioned in the book. We've got Emperor Constantine, who was vying to become the supreme being in the Roman Emperor, in the Roman Empire. You know, and he claimed that he witnessed a flying cross.
Hmm.
Excuse me, we have flying crosses in 1967 on the Moyne Downs, which I think are in Dorset.
Yeah.
You know, so they are seeing things come in waves. You know, we can come up to today where we get things like oblong shaped boxes flying off of, you know, the English Channel. And like, then 3 years later, or is it 3 years earlier? I can't remember. I always get that one mixed up. That we have something similar being seen up at Conyers in Georgia, in the USA.
Yeah.
So what is it? Why do these things come in kind of like a sequence, really?
Yeah.
Over many, many years, you know?
Mm. Well, it's like I've heard some people say, well, we don't get many egg-shaped reports, because obviously
Lenny Zamora.
Yeah.
You know, and having said that, in the book, there's actually a very, very good picture of a lenticular cloud that is egg-shaped, which was taken over Iceland. Reykjavik, I think, is the capital of Iceland.
Yeah.
You know, and that's only a few years ago.
Mm.
From a distance, it could be mistaken for an egg-shaped UFO.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the famous sighting over the football match in Florence in the 1950s has been described as people seeing a flying saucer. All the witnesses described it being egg-shaped, Chris.
And also, another witness described that one as being cigar-shaped.
Yeah.
So, again, two witnesses to the same event saw two different shapes.
Yeah, yeah. And that's before you even get to the stuff falling from the sky over everybody, which was dismissed as ballooning spiders.
Yeah. Also, I called it angel air as well, which was, of course, going back to the 1950s, was a regular occurrence.
Yeah.
You know, I think didn't George Adamski mention angel air at least once in one of his descriptions of a sighting?
Yeah, and there's been a few occasions where people have actually captured some of it and had it analysed, and it's a natural product.
The very case you've just mentioned, Florence in Italy, 1954, I think it was October 1954, it was Florentina or something like that, Italian football team who were playing a local rival team, where they actually said all that.
Yeah, yeah. Pistone, I think, was the team they were playing.
That's correct, yeah, thank you. God, you said that. It's easy for you to say.
But once again, there we are. Smack in the middle of the 1950s, we've got people describing crafts that are not what the media conversation is. These are either witness. You could say, Chris, depending on your perspective of where you were in the stadium, something egg-shaped might look a bit like a cigar if you were looking at it from a certain angle.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But that case is, of course, one that led to a young lad who you'll probably know, and your listeners or your viewers probably will know, who was interested in the subject. And it shows that he was interested in the subject. He lived in, I think it was Bromley in London at the time, and his name was David Jones.
Yeah.
So who did he become? David Bowie.
Yeah.
Spiders from Mars, which again is what was described as falling from the craft in Florence in 1954. Yeah. He named his band after that.
Yeah, yeah.
Crazy, isn't it?
It is. Are you surprised that some of these odd shaped vehicles are not more well known? Because some of them are, you know, some cases when you come across them, you just think, why do people not know about this? And I've forgotten the chap's name, but the missionary out in the Pacific who had that sighting.
Oh yes, Father Gill.
That's it. Yeah. I mean, that sighting's amazing on several levels, because the one thing that's always struck me about that is, here is a man of the cloth, and you would suggest that if he saw something in the sky, he would perhaps say it would be an angel. Or angels, perhaps, you would think. Mm-hmm. Maybe, Chris. But he said, no, this was definitely some kind of craft. And the fact he was waving at them and they waved back.
Waving back, yeah.
It always made me laugh. It's remarkable, really.
Why would a man of the cloth lie?
Yes.
That's the first question that you need to ask. What were the reasons why he would lie?
Mm.
I don't know. Perhaps he could have had reasons. But it's very, very, it's highly unlikely that he would lie because of the position that he was in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's all, as with any profession of a certain ilk, Chris, the reputational damage that can occur to them, as we both know, the number of pilots that have seen things and been told to keep quiet or whatever.
Yeah.
And war betide, well, certainly in the older days, it seems a bit more sort of honest and open about these things these days.
I'll tell you what is a good thing, Paul. is that the US Navy, and by implication we can presume the US Air Force as well, have actually changed the reporting procedures when pilots do see UFOs. Mm. So that is a step in the right direction. It's a step to more openness. And of course, as we know, in the president's recent bill, they'll put in protection for people who want to be whistleblowers, yeah, who want to come forward. This is why people like David Grush have come forward. Mm. And, you know, they're putting their two penny worth in. Mm. Whether anything will ever come of all that remains to be seen. But, you know, let's hope it carries on and we get more and more witnesses coming forward.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you only have to look at what's gone on with the Calvine photo, Chris, over the last few years, and the incredible work that David Clark did to finally track that down. I mean, the fact that David took it upon himself to go up there and just knock on doors till he found somebody, yeah, who knew, yeah, what he was talking about is an interesting thing. And I've heard you mention this, and I'd never really considered this point that you made, Chris, and it's an excellent one. I think sometimes gets overlooked when we're talking about this. For most people, I think the reputation of the Calvine photo is entirely based on what Nick Pope had said about this picture, yeah, that they got above his desk in the MOD that everybody said was the best evidence of a UFO sighted over British skies. And he described it and whatever, up to the point that he was still going on about it till we got the hold of the photo.
Yeah.
And he described it, and I know that I think the Sun did a mock-up of it. And you mentioned this, that either he must have a copy of that photo, or mm-hmm, he's got a photographic memory, because what he described and how the mock-up came out is virtually identical to the original, yeah, photo.
I think if I remember correctly, the actual diamond-shaped unknown is just slightly away from where it is on the photograph. So it's, but it's not that far away in reality. And if I remember correctly as well, Paul, and please correct me if I'm wrong, it's about the same height, you know, mm, in the picture.
Yes, dimensions.
In the two different pictures, should I say.
Yeah.
So it's a fascinating thing. Avery's got a copy, and, you know, I spoke to Nick at Awakening last year, and I forgot to ask him about that, to be honest. I was too busy asking him about other things for my then podcast that I used to do. Anyway, you know, if he's got a photographic memory, then it's a bloody good one. That's all I can say. He's, you know, his negatives are being damaged in any way by the look of that image.
the fact that he's got such a clear recollection of it, because I think for anybody who's interested in any particular subject, if they can look at what's going on and they see a case or they see a particular image, I think any of us would struggle to remember something we saw 30 years ago, Chris.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with that totally, Paul. You know, I mean, I have trouble remembering my wife's birthday from year to year, never mind anything else. So remembering what I did 30 years ago, you know, well, 30 years ago, 1994, I can't even remember where I was working, to be quite honest with you, Paul.
Yeah, I only remember it because it's got more ramifications in the wider scope of things. But I'd be struggling if you said to me, what did you do on a specific day? Or, yeah, you know, and I did some amazing things in 1994, but I can't tell you exactly when, where and who I was with.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just everyday life takes up, doesn't it, for the average gentleman. So, you know, yeah, perhaps Nick Pope does have his uses.
Moving on.
Let's move on.
So when you were sitting down and compiling this, were you surprised at certain objects being as prevalent as they are in this, Chris? Because as we were saying, at the beginning of the book, you've got a list that has been reproduced that gives you a complete breakdown of specific shapes and sizes. Most people would talk about, as we've mentioned, saucers, triangles, balls of fire, diamond-shaped objects. And yet, there seems to be so many, you know, dozens of different shapes and sizes that people have reported.
Yeah, I mean, that list is actually based on NUFORC, as I mentioned earlier, that there are 147,000, I think it was, reports. The particular shape that we don't seem to get a lot of is chevron shaped. You know, 1,631 they had in you know, that number of years. Cigar shaped, 3,582. Circle, or should we say flying saucers, for want of a better argument, 15,191. You know, cone-shaped, You know, I'm not saying this is an ice cream, but cone-shaped, 582. Cross-shaped, 471. You know, delta-shaped, 36. Discs, 8,414. And there's one that we kind of like mentioned, egg shapes, 1,225. You know, and other shapes are 9,756. Now, what those other shapes are, I haven't got a clue. Flashes of light, 2,383. You know, flying triangles, 12,709. So they are still going on. You know, and that comes to, I said 147. It's not. It's 142,333 up till November 2022. But, you know, I decided to put the book together, basically, Paul, it was more of a refresher for myself more than anything else. Because as I think I explained it in the book, I took a number of years away. Yeah. I kind of like left, although I'd still keep looking for information or reading bits if there was in the newspaper. Mm. I kind of moved away after Graham Birtle passed on.
Yeah,
I went away for about 12, 13, 14 years or so. Mm. And I came back to it and I thought, like, well, I'm going to have to read up on different things to see what's been going on, what information is out there, what information isn't out there, and just get everything together. So it was more of a refresher course for myself more than anything else that I decided to put the book together. And, you know, I've had people say to me, it doesn't matter if you've been an avid or interested person for 3 months or for 50 years, like I have been this year, it's good to have a refresher course to remind ourselves of the many different types of shapes and different sizes of these things that have been seen over the years.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, as with anything in any walk of life, Chris, I think sometimes we can trip ourselves up and fall into a trap that we think, oh, I don't need to revise that, I don't need to go over it, it's all in here. How many times do I need to go over something over and over again? And often I think if you leave something for a while, as you did, when you go back to something, you're kind of looking at it through a fresh pair of eyes or with a slightly different perspective. Did you find that when you were going back, that there were certain cases that different things jumped out to you?
It's actually funny that you should say that, because I've just had a case we brought back to my attention today, thanks to Jean Libreiro over in France, who's just sent me a brilliant article about a case over there in Chile, which occurred, I think it was in 1977, where a group of soldiers were out patrolling a hillside near a stable, which was quite high up a mountain in the Andes. And the corporal came, it kind of like, they all saw these lights in the sky. It's at least two lights, what red, other ends of like a purpley light formation.
Mm.
Anyway, the corporal ended up disappearing, and he was missing for 15 minutes, according to what many of the soldiers claimed. Mm. He was missing for 15 minutes, but he came back with 5 days of beard growth. So what had happened there? You know, it's great to get all this old information in retrospect and have a refresher. And I'm absolutely grateful to Jean Librero for sending me that over today. You know, he sent that in English for me, so that'll be going in the next issue of the mag.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you only have to look at what's gone on with Pascagoula, Chris, to see a case that, like I say, obviously I got to know you guys yourself and Philip and Paul when we met at that conference back in 2019, and Philip was there obviously talking about the documentary that they'd done about Calvin, mm-hmm. and the book that had just come out. And then you look at where we are now, 5 years later, we've had Maria Blair come forward, we've got all these other witnesses that have come out, more articles, more information, lost tapes have reappeared.
Yeah.
And I think when you see that that's what's happening with Pascagoula, there's clearly cases out there that are exactly the same, that we might think it's all done and dusted, we've found everything, and then somebody clears out a cupboard or somebody's father or mother passes away and they find a box of documents full of stuff and you like go, we've hit a gold mine here.
Absolutely. There are many, many cases, in my opinion, that are like that. You know, it's it never surprises me, to be quite honest with you, Paul, what information does come through. And the very fact as you mentioned, the Pascagoula case, the very fact that information is, don't forget, this happened in 1973. It was actually a forgotten case.
Yeah.
Most of us had forgotten all about it. Those of us that were around about 73, 74 as I got involved, kind of knew of it, but it was always on like on the back burner. Yeah. It was hiding away in the back of the grey matter. And the work that Philip Mantle and Dr. Irina Scott have done in bringing what was a forgotten case, which is now at the forefront of the abduction phenomena, in my opinion, they need commendating, really, don't they? Need some kind of award, although I give Phil an award a couple of years ago.
I was going to say,
at the Outer Limits magazine. He's not getting any more, Phil.
I don't think his mantelpiece is that big, Chris.
Oh, no, it's not his mantelpiece. It's his front room in his house. You want to see it? It's absolutely full of memorabilia. It's absolutely amazing when you go.
Yeah. Well, perhaps we can think of some other sort of... Make him a fake medal or something, Chris.
I don't know. Make him... I think we ought to get him on TV, you know. I remember, I think it was on Noel's house party many, many years ago when a UFO was allegedly landed in somebody's garden. I think it was Noel's house party.
Oh, Beadles About.
Oh, that's it. Beadles About. Yes, correct, yeah. And we need to do something like that to Phil. I'm sure. I know what Phil would do. He'd just get out of it, you silly bugger. You know, that kind of thing. You know, but they need some kind of praise for the work that they've done. Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, when you were pulling the book together, Chris, was there any case that shocked you, made you feel uneasy, made you worried that perhaps you didn't have those feelings to 20 years ago, that perhaps coming back to it, as I said, with a fresh pair of eyes and a refreshed perspective on the subject, that's sent to chill up your spine? Because I know sometimes there are sometimes moments. I remember Whitley Strieber is a prime example of this, that I remember stumbling across Communion when I was a teenager on holiday with my family in Portugal, and I saw the book for sale, and I thought, bloody hell, what, Alien on the front of that, ooh, I'm going to buy that. And I bought it and read it and was terrified a few days later when the local shop had its bottle bin emptied at 5 a.m, Chris, waking up thinking, what the hell, who's coming for, you know, is coming through the window for me?
Yeah.
And I kind of got a little bit au fait and not too fussed about the case, as intriguing and as obsessed with it as I was at that period of my life. And then over the last year or so, I've listened to some more interviews he did in the late 90s. And they've given me a real sense of unease these days, which I never had sort of after I'd read Communion initially and gone forward with it and knew it. And even watching the film and things, Chris. Now, there are certain aspects of that that really do make me feel far more uneasy than I ever had in my period of my life.
I must say, things that I've read over the years, the only real things that have kind of like spooked me or made me a little bit nervous are really them ghost stories that I mentioned, you know, being 13, 14 years of age. Things don't seem to spook me out as much nowadays. But there is, I mentioned October 1967 earlier about the flying crosses seen off of the UK. There is a case it there, which was A.W. Brooks, who was an ex-RAF officer during the Second World War. And he was actually a photographic expert.
Mm.
So he had a good photographic memory for detail, et cetera, et cetera. And he was good at, you know, investigating images when they came into him.
Yeah.
He'd retired from the RAF by 1967. And on one particular day, he had a couple of dogs, a couple of pets. And he decided to take the dogs for a walk. And he was on the Moyne Downs, as I mentioned earlier. And it's a bit of an hilly area, you know, and a wind had blown up, a quite, you know, terrific wind had blown up from somewhere when he was out there walking his dogs. It's about 11 o'clock in the morning. And he thinks to himself, right, I'm just going to, you know, sit down for a little bit while the dogs have a run around. So he sat in a dip, a fold in the ground, and he's laid back, and it was a dry day. He's laid back on the grass and he's looking up, and he notices this device in the sky, and this device is watching, and it suddenly disappears, but it's replaced by a flying cross. And that flying cross starts coming down towards him, right? Anyway, after a while, it watched it for 22 minutes. It was actually flying against the wind. It was stationary, and I think it was moving a little bit here and there against the direction of the wind. And what actually happened is eventually it just disappeared. So anyway, it reports this, and the MOD gets to hear of it.
Hmm.
So they send three experts to interview him. And after a while, the report comes back. And the report says, and you're never going to believe this, he actually witnessed something in his dream while he was sleeping, while he's looking after two dogs, which are running around him on an open field in the middle of the Moyne Downs in Dorset. He actually witnessed and said it was something in his dream, or it was a piece of dead matter in the back of his eye, floating around, a floater, basically. No, I think their opinion is a bit of a floater, to be quite honest with you.
Of a different type.
Yeah, it certainly is. You know, as you can imagine, he was not impressed once he got this back, you know, and he made it known that he wasn't impressed as well. Yeah. A.W. Brooks, if people don't know about it, look, I think it's October the 25th, 1967. But the previous day, we have another report of events going on in the south of England. I think that was another flying cross, which was, I think it was in the Sussex area.
Mm.
They witnessed flying crosses. And in fact, the next day, it was the day after A.W. Brooks anyway. Mm. We have another five police officers in five separate cars chasing a UFO, which was seen at 40 foot above the ground. And it was flying along the roads at 80 miles an hour. Guess what the MOD said?
Venus.
Spot on. Spot on. How great are the MOD? You know, I've never known Venus to fly down a country road at 80 miles an hour.
Yeah.
I don't know about you, Paul.
No.
So it's them kind of reports that I like to read.
Yeah.
Because it just shows to me how stupid the MOD have been over the years.
Yeah.
No defence significance.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Or how stupid they think we are, Chris.
If it was of defence significance, Paul, we'd have known by now.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. It reminds me, there's a similar case Preston Dennett covered in one of his books, where a woman was so scared by an object that came and stopped above her that she wet herself. And she was also told that she'd seen Venus.
Mm.
Now, I've seen Venus lots, Chris. It's never made me want to wet myself because it's frightened me that much. Or it's been that big. I mean, this is the... Yeah. You've got... that's a prime example of some of the things that people have put forward as explanations to people, that you've got five police officers who, I would imagine, have been involved in high-speed pursuits at some period in their careers.
We're all... Don't forget, they're all credible witnesses.
Yep. Yep, absolutely. And are all dismissed as all mistaking Venus. I know there's a similar case in the US that happened in the 90s, I think, where numerous police officers were sort of speaking to each other, saying, we're seeing something in the sky. I think they were also told that they'd all mistaken a star or Venus or something, and they were all just chasing a light in the sky.
I remember something about that, but I cannot remember which one it was.
Yeah.
And let's be honest, I'm not going to jump at any names or anything like that, because America is a big place.
Yeah.
You know, you could soon get a state name wrong or something.
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, anybody that watches the sky will know, yes, of course, planets and stars move, but not to that extent that someone's going to chase something, surely.
Not that fast, absolutely not.
You know? I mean, often I often watch the sky where I live. I'm quite lucky we've got a big window where I can sit down and sit here and I can see a nice sky. I'll see drones zipping about and all kinds of things all over the place, especially where we are, Chris. And sometimes I'll see things, and often when you look at the night sky, it takes your eyes a while to get used to it, and then all of a sudden you suddenly see all kinds of stars, constellations and things that at first glance you don't see. And until you take the time to absorb what you're looking at, you can make a mistake.
Absolutely.
If you're seeing something zipping about the sky, then I'm sorry, that's not a planet or a star.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So it just shows you how ridiculous some of the explanations from, those in control have put forward over the years. You know, this is why you say NASA could have gone back and looked at the evidence of the past 70 years to at least 1947.
Yeah.
You know, look at the evidence of the Foo Fighters, which American pilots actually experienced during the Second World War, as well as Nazi pilots and British pilots. They all experienced them.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, well, they all thought they were each other, didn't they?
Absolutely.
Nazis thought it was us, and we thought it was them.
Absolutely.
So why would two sides of a conflict both make up stories about something? It makes no sense, Chris.
Absolutely. And then again, don't forget, Paul, after the Second World War, we had the rockets, you know, off of Sweden.
Yes.
And even Norway had them as well.
Yeah.
You know, we had an article in OLM Mag a few issues back about events that had taken place in Norway after the Second World War.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It is surprising when you look at certain countries as well. I know you mentioned it earlier on, Chile. There are certain countries that seem to be very, very open and honest and interested in this subject and don't hide it. Chile is a prime example.
A lot of South American countries are that way. Mm. I think Peru, Chile, I think Brazil, and I even think our good old friends over there, the Argentines, are a little bit open about all that as well.
Yeah.
You know, so it's fascinating. Why can't more of the Western world be like that? Why do they think, having said that though, France is one country that is open about past reports and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
They've put a lot of information out, and yeah. I think Italy has done so as well. Mm. You know, we have we had a case which was, I mean, I know David Rush mentioned it, I think last year, about the Nazi Italian fascist flying saucers.
Yeah.
But we reported on that in Outer Limits magazine, not in 2023, we needed it. We reported and had an article about that in 2020.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if people want to be informed about what's going on, get your hands in Outer Limits magazine.
Yeah, there are these things often, especially when it comes to the continent. You know, as we touched on earlier on, people say, oh, well, the Belgian wave was made up and all this. But, you know, this completely ignores the radar data. The people that were involved in the Belgian Air Force were sending fighter pilots up. People go, oh, well...
Unless, of course, we're chasing Venus. You know,
it's decorous in their eyes.
You get my point, Paul. Yeah. I'm sure you do.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But then people say, oh, well, if they were seeing them in Belgium, why didn't anybody report them anywhere else? And at first
they
I thought...
They came across to Britain.
Exactly. Well, they were also seen in Germany, Switzerland, yep. and France. But yep. these are the things that if you just look at what certain outlets will tell you, you'll go, oh, well, it was just somebody having a laugh or yeah. somebody taking a picture. That was dismissed as, was it a lampshade, the Belgian photo?
Oh, yeah.
Something like that, Chris.
Yeah.
But until you look into it, you realise that other countries were seeing this, obviously in the same flight path. And like you say, we had some sightings at the same time.
I'm not. Having said that, though, there are people out there who we know, as you do, Paul, who will fake sightings just for their 15 minutes of fame.
Yeah.
We had the what was classed as a light shade. Was I forget the name of the gentleman now? Was it in Florida back in?
Oh,
was it not Key West?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, the Key West.
Was it Key West?
Key West sightings, yeah.
Yes, that's correct, yeah. So people will do that, and they will fake information. Now, whether they're planted there for whatever reason, it very well could be, because others want to control the narrative.
Yeah.
You know, there is still, you know, just checking New Fork again, for example, 142,000 cases. You know, that's 142,000 separate witnesses.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sightings that have occurred.
Mm.
Not everybody can be wrong.
Yeah, and not everybody can be a plant either, Chris.
Exactly.
And if they are, why are they all? If we're expected to believe that people are just making stuff up, well, why aren't they all seeing the same things? This is the thing about there are nuances to certain sightings that you know that person either has no interest in the subject or no knowledge, because often if somebody's has an interest in any particular subject, if they're interested in ghosts or Bigfoot or UFOs, Chris, and they have an experience, people automatically say, oh, well, they know about it. Well, you would hope they do. That's why they're interested.
I think it was Alan Hynek who made a comment about, about descriptions, where he said, you know, people are explaining, all these sightings, basically, he was saying that if they're all fake, why don't we get they're all this shape or they're all that shape or they could all be this shape or that, but they're not.
Mm.
They're not all weird sightings. They're all a lot of them are quite sensible,
yeah,
if we can call them sensible, you know, explanations from the ordinary people,
yeah,
who have seen extraordinary things.
Yeah.
So we are being visited. We've been visited for millennia. They come in many different shapes. You know, when the reason they come in many different shapes, I mean, take ourselves. I've used this description before. You know, when we look at the cars that we have, they're not the same cars that we had in 1900, 1910. They've changed. They've advanced. And so have the craft that these creatures, these visitors, are actually coming in. And the craft itself will change, I think, for the description of the job that it's got to do.
Yes.
For example, a flying fire engine, an aircraft that drops water, is going to look different to an aircraft that carries passengers.
Yeah. Yeah.
Simple as that.
Yeah, absolutely. And why wouldn't they? If you have a technologically advanced civilization, Chris, why would they not have different craft for different tasks?
Absolutely. You know, as I say, the cars that we had in 1905, 1910 are not the same now. You know, I could imagine going out in a car that you put in 1905 and have to be dressed up to the nines in weather like this.
Yeah, I feel sorry for the man walking in front of you waving his flag.
Red flag, yeah. do you remember them, Paul?
Hey, I can just about remember Ford Cortinas, Chris.
I remember them. And Ford Zephyrs.
So, obviously the book's been out a few weeks now. Chris, how's the reception been? Have you found that people are surprised by the fact that there is such a variation in the craft that people see?
Well, I must admit I'm surprised. And it's actually kind of like made me feel pretty humble, really. I mean, I've had a wonderful review from Malcolm Robinson. He basically said, you know, it's a brilliant book. It should be on every single person's library shelf. I had a friend answer him back, though, when he put that up. Said, no, it would be better if people aren't reading it, you know. But it's... I'm completely humbled. I mean, Peter Robbins has done me a fantastic forward.
Yep.
Extremely grateful for that from Peter.
Yep.
Philip Mantle. I was actually hinting about me and him putting something together a couple of years back, maybe about 3 years or so ago now. And I knew he had all this on with Pascagoula and Calvin Parker and everything. So it never happened. But he turned around to me and said, look, he said, if you write it, I'll publish it for you. It still took me 2 years to write it, I must admit, but, you know, the words from him, from people like yourself, Paul, you know, and people like Paul Sinclair and others, and many others. If I've forgotten your name, I apologise. But, you know, we've had all those kind of people write and say it's a good book, people should read it. And, you know, well, I enjoyed reading it anyway.
Well, so did I. And I think, as Malcolm says, for me, it's an essential catalogue, Chris, just to show the variety and scope of vehicles and crafts that people see. Because I think with things like this, often you can get overlooked in regards to a book concentrating on specific cases or things like that. And I think when you look at it in a more sort of material way, when we're looking at what people are saying and seeing and explaining and describing, I think that, as we were saying earlier on, takes it into a different level of, well, these clearly aren't dreams or fantasies or people wanting 15 minutes of fame. God knows why anybody would want 15 minutes of fame.
Especially with the ridicule that used to come with the subject, which, let's be honest, it is dying down a little bit.
Yep.
But it's still there. People are going to be ridiculed. Yep. We've got your tinfoil hat on. How's Cousin Zog, you know?
Yeah. I mean, there are still cases when I hear them or read them in all kinds of phenomena. I do take a sharp intake of breath because I'm just going... I'm not sure about this one, but there are some that you see and you just think, as we mentioned there, often you will get a case where somebody will just describe something very matter of fact. There's no bells and whistles and floral decoration to their descriptions, Chris. They'll just say what they've seen. And often it's the mundaneness and the banality of a description that takes it to a different level for me regardless of the phenomenon, that because it seems so matter of fact, that gives it a bit more credence than somebody saying, oh, yeah, well, they came and they told me that such and such is going to be the prime minister and there's going to be a volcano blow up such and such a place. It's the normality of the fact that, yes, they're talking about something we don't really understand, but it's a very normal description.
Yeah, I tend to shy away from the what I call the Space Brothers. You know, we've got to change our ways. We've got to, you know, the Earth's dying. That, you know, we need to get rid of nuclear power and all this kind of stuff. I tend to shy away from that. And that, I'm not saying that didn't happen today, but it was mostly a 1950s, coming 1960s kind of following. Yeah. You know, but in the book itself, you know, in part one, there's modern and historical shaped sightings. You know, cross-shaped UFOs, square, rectangle and cube-shaped UFOs, diamond-shaped lenticular clouds there, flying triangles, cigar-shaped UFOs, V or boomerang-shaped UFOs, you know, even donut-shaped UFOs. Unfortunately, they don't come with jamming. But, you know, we get other oddly-shaped UFOs.
Yeah.
Questions and more questions. Then there's an epilogue and a conclusion. Mm-hmm. You know, but it is a fantastic little book. You know, I'm saying that myself, but even Howard Hughes, you know, from Talk TV, Talk Radio, has actually said that himself as well. Mm. And, he was well over the moon with it. And I'm ever so grateful for everything that people have said, people that have interviewed me like yourself, you know, and people who've come forward or helped in the production of the book as well.
Yeah, well, you should be very proud of it, Chris. I think it's a great book, and for a first time collection, bravo you. And I'm obviously as this given you an appetite to stretch your writing fingers a bit more and carry on, because obviously I know, as we touched on earlier on, you still publish the bi-monthly Outer Limits magazine, Chris. So is it something that it's given you a thirst to pull another book together, or is there another case or part of this subject that you want to sort of address next?
No. I'm joking, of course. What I'm actually doing at the moment, I'm putting another book together about USOs.
Ah.
But not only unidentified submerged objects, but unidentified submarine objects.
Mm.
So I've got everything in there from anything that's to do with water, basically, you know, Lake Baikal. I've got the events around the Catalina Islands in America. I know people have covered these before, but I'm even what I've done in that is I've split it into like areas of the world.
Yeah.
Americas, South America, and there are plenty from South America as well. Mm. You know, Europe, Africa, Asia, Australia and places like that. So I'm always looking for anything on unidentified submersible objects, submarine objects. You know, if people want to email me at theouterlimitsmag@gmail.com, let me get that right. Yeah, theouterlimitsmag@gmail.com. They can send me any reports that they've got or they know of. You know, they'll get a little mention in the book. This is from XYZ individual, you know. Mm. So, you know, if you want to send me them, that'd be appreciated.
Certainly, absolutely. Well, I'll put links to that. Obviously, coming up later this year, you've got the return to doing a conference, because you have to move it onwards from last year. So I'm looking forward to that. I'm very, very glad that you've decided to hold it on my birthday, Chris. That's very kind of you to honour me in such a way.
Well, you don't know you're buying everybody a drink before you get one back, don't you?
Hey,
that's a whole tradition, mate. There you go. No, yeah, we're at 14th of September.
Yeah,
it's at the Hull University. Mm-hmm. It's in the Canham Turner Building. Mm-hmm. It's not in the Middleton Hall where last year's was planned.
Yeah,
but this is in the Canham Turner Building. I can get up to 350 people in there.
Yeah,
if they, you know, people want to come along. Speakers is myself. I'll probably be doing something about this book,
mm-hmm.
or possibly the USO publication, if it's finished in time.
Mm-hmm.
There's myself doing that. I'll be hosting it as well. There's Jason Gleaves, who was an ex-RAF photographic analyst. He is. He's a very good one as well. He's also an author. He'll be coming along and doing us a talk. Graham Rendell, mm-hmm. who's very well known in the subject. I don't think Graham describes himself as a ufologist, but I think he is secretly, because, you know, he's going back to things like Foo Fighters and Nazi UFOs and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
So he'll be doing a talk for us. I did have Ronnie Kinsella, but for private reasons, Ronnie's had to pull out. But we've now replaced him with another Yorkshireman by the name of Paul Ascoff. He's already done a presentation for us a couple of years ago. And those who witnessed his presentation told me they really, really enjoyed it a couple of years ago. And actually, Paul volunteered as soon as he found out that Ronnie had pulled out. Mm. So I gladly accepted that. And he's jumped onto the bandwagon as well.
Brilliant.
As I mentioned, I'll be doing a talk. And also, a young man by the name of, is new to the subject, by the name of Paul Sinclair. Now, I'm pulling everybody's leg. Paul is indeed coming to do a talk for us. And I know he's going to be busy in next month in at the Awakening in Bolton.
Yeah.
So he'll be doing that. But in September, he'll be returning back to Hull and doing us a talk in Hull. So I have got at least another one or two guests to announce. I have got a gentleman coming in from the United States, who I won't mention right now. It will be mentioned on the Sunday, at the end of this very week that we're speaking in, and we're on the 8th of January right now. Mm-hmm. So just a few days away, and you'll be getting a mention, and that'll be going out publicly to everybody. And I'm hoping I can get one more English presenter who has had a fascination with the subject for many, many years. But again, I'm not going to mention any names until we get a little bit closer.
Tickets are only £20, aren't they? And £15 for subscribers.
If you're a subscriber to the magazine, it's £15, because you automatically get that discount when you subscribe to the mag.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're a non-subscriber, it's £20. These are ticket prices each, of course. And they can get the information on how to get the tickets from www.olm-mag.co.uk. Just go to the conference page and then just email the relative, you know, with your relative information. There isn't a link on there. You need to copy and paste in. But if you copy and paste it into your email client, you'll get that offer to me. And as soon as you tell me what tickets you want, you know, how many tickets you want, they'll be sent off to you once it's been paid. And I'll send you an invoice on there, on Stripe, which it works exactly the same as PayPal, and you don't need an account.
Brilliant. Well, I'll put links to everything in the show notes for everybody, Chris. Once again, it's a fabulous book. As Malcolm mentioned, it should be anybody with an interest in ufology needs this on there. Purely, as we were saying, as a catalogue, as a reference, as a book you can dive in and out of. It's one of those that you can come back to it time and time again. I wish you the very best of luck with your next project. And thank you for finally joining me. It's been lovely to have a real chat and pick your brains about all things UFOs, sir.
Thank you very much, Paul. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you very much for the invite. I don't know if it's too late now, the 8th of January, but Happy New Year to yourself,
the same
your
to
loved
you.
Ones, and to all your listeners and viewers wherever they are. That's if you've got viewers, of course. I don't know. What am I not about?
Thanks, Chris. You take care, and I hope we'll speak again.
Thank you very much, Paul. Bye bye.